favorite scary movie. Have you checked the children?
It's all for you!
We have such sights to show you.
Hello, one and all. This is the Horrible People's Podcast Christmas edition. I am here with God's favorite cherub, Alex Webster.
You messed up my name, but welcome, gentle viewers, to the Christmas episode of our, well, first of our Christmas episodes of our podcast. We will be covering the 1958 classic, The Fly.
Hold on there, Webster. We're covering the 1986 version of The Fly, not the Kurt Newman one. Do you know what that means?
It's Cronenberg Christmas, motherfuckers! Welcome to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex. I'm always joined by Anthony over here.
Yeah, she didn't even attempt my last name to mess it up. Yep, oh. Anthony.
Anthony Fuentes.
That's right. I fucked up her name already. But, hey, everybody.
Because I can say your last name.
I know, right? It's a little harder to... whatever. But we are here covering a very special thing that we want to keep up for years to come. It is a Cronenberg Christmas, you pieces of shit. Goddamn.
This was Anthony's idea. We really wanted to go with something festive, but also something that would be a good tradition to maintain. And Cronenberg is kind of my bitch, so...
Yeah, and I didn't realize Cronenberg was to the level of being her bitch. I didn't know that. So I'm actually really excited about this because I've only seen like a couple Cronenberg films.
I've seen far too many.
Yeah, he has like a mythological kind of like thing for me. Oh, that's a Cronenberg thing.
Yeah, totally. There's a lot to unpack with Cronenberg, but we are covering the remake of The Fly from 1958. This is now, we are traveling in time to 1986.
Yep, that's a 28-year jump right there, but we got it. We can cover it.
It's you know what? It's like one of those, it's one of the remakes that people weren't bitching about, because apparently everyone's really angry at remakes right now.
No, that's true. Yeah, I was looking at the reception for this, and people were like, oh no, this is actually much better than the...
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That's because the original Fly was more geared as a sci-fi flick versus a horror flick, which is what this version
one is, yeah, which is why we can cover it.
Becoming, which is why we're covering it. So we will be covering, like I said, The Fly, directed by David Cronenberg.
Not Kurt Newman. I don't know what happened to that guy.
So, you know, for those of you who don't know what The Fly is, the brief synopsis is: a brilliant but eccentric scientist begins to transform into a giant man-fly hybrid after one of his experiments goes horribly wrong, which is a great one-line fucking, like,
it actually,
this is what the movie is.
It encapsulates it really well, because it's a simple plot, but, like, there's so much to the movie. There's a lot.
Yeah. So, obviously directed by David fucking Cronenberg. Yeah. The writer for the short story is George Langlin.
There's a lot of A's in there.
Yeah. And then Charles Edward Pogue wrote the screenplay. He shares writing credits with David Cronenberg, and we'll go into that later. The movie stars, obviously, as everyone knows, Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis.
Oh, wonderful Gina Davis.
She's so hot.
This is like peak Gina Davis in this fucking
so
film.
She's so hot. I'm going to get into this later, but they were married.
Yeah.
Like, they were together.
They were together and married a year afterwards, right?
Yes. I'll go into it later, but I'm just like... This is like one of those 90s relationships that I had no idea even occurred.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it fell off the radar.
It totally, like, people didn't even know. Like, I brought this up to my friends, and they were like, they were married. And I'm like, right? What, like, what would you give to be in a threesome with that couple?
Gina Davis, man.
Yeah.
Way to go, Goldblum. That put his stock up right there.
I mean, but also Jeff Goldblum, like, continues to have stock to this day.
I assume, yes.
Like, most people, like, are still, to this day, Jeff Goldblum, as he is now in the year of our Lord 2018, would still bang him.
I would love to age like Jeff Goldblum. That man, I don't know what it is.
But yeah, so those are our two main cast members. John Getz is Stathis Borens, What a douche.
Fucking guy. Okay.
And
already with a hated character that I have right now.
I know. You always right have there. A hated fucking character.
In particular, this one, though. He get, yes. He'd get me too in a hot fucking minute.
Oh, yeah.
On this one.
Yeah.
He's just one frame away from putting his dick on a table.
Right?
Yeah. But, like, not all the way, because it's probably small as shit. Like, his character sucks.
Yeah. So, let's see here. So, the budget for the film, it's either $9 million or $15 million.
I've seen some conflicting sources on this one.
So the budget is a little
I think it's one of those situations where if you see it on a documentary or something, it's $9 million. But if you actually look at the numbers, it's like, no, it was actually 15. We're going to promote it like it's $9, though.
Make it seem like a smaller budget. But the opening weekend, it made $7 million.
Nice.
And its gross USA earnings is a little little over $40 million.
Yeah, that's pretty good for that budget.
And then cumulative worldwide is $20 million. So total, it made about 60.
Yep, 60 that's pretty
million,
good.
So
on return on investment's pretty high on that one. That's nice. For
sure.
A horror especially.
Yeah, for
sure. Well, no, horrors always have a good ROI, but
right. 80s. So so let's dive right in. We're gonna go over. Let's see here. We're gonna go over the production of the film. We're gonna go over some deleted and alternate scenes.
Ooh.
We're going to go over the makeup and special effects, which was completely groundbreaking at the time.
And it still looks fucking amazing.
And it still looks so good. No. The reception and legacy. And I'm going to talk a little bit about David Cronenberg and body horror and the importance of that in relation to The Fly.
Yes.
Which is, this is where I make my bitch.
Yeah, no, exactly. She's got this whole method down.
Yeah.
This down pat.
And then we're going to talk a little bit about the movie proper. But we really just wanted, this one for me, I kind of wanted to just focus on the production, because it actually has a very interesting production story.
Yeah,
as we will discover.
It totally does. It's a lot of more Hollywood-y kind of stuff, guys.
Yeah.
So just so you know, that's how it always is.
But yeah, so the score was composed by Howard Shore, and the makeup effects was created by Chris Wallace. This might be a familiar name to some of you. Chris Wallace directed The Fly 2. He was also one of the co-creators for Gremlins, and he's partially responsible for the famous melting Nazi faces scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Dude's got a pedigree.
Yes,
he's got a fucking pedigree right there.
And he is also was a makeup artist along with Stephen Dupuy.
Dupuy?
Yeah, it's French.
Okay.
Both Dupuy and Wallace won an Academy Award for Best Makeup in The Fly. Dupuy. He worked on a ton of sequels, but his noted works include RoboCop, Scanners, another Cronenberg flick,
Ooh.
The Fly 2, Jason X, Poltergeist 3, and I Am Legend. So he's a thing for sequels.
That's a gradual decline in quality right there. although RoboCop, yeah.
I've never seen RoboCop.
It's body horror, fucking brutality.
Yeah.
RoboCop's up there, for
All
sure.
Right. But yeah, so the film was released on August 15th, 1986, to massive acclaim by critics and audiences, mainly with praise going to the special effects in the film and Goldblum's performance.
Oh yeah, this is Pete Goldblum. You thought Jurassic Park was Pete Goldblum? No, this
You know what? I love Goldblum in all of his forms, so
true.
All Goldblum is Pete Goldblum for me.
That's a good point, because he stays very steady.
Yeah.
He's very steadily Goldblum.
He has a good career. Like
that's true.
He's good at what he does, for sure, no doubt.
I feel like this is the most Goldblum, though. Like,
yeah.
He's just, they give him just like, he just chew up everything, and he's like, all right, I get 90 minutes, cool.
Right, yeah.
I can do all this. Ugh. But as we go into it, let's learn a little bit about how this fucking movie was made, all right, guys?
Yeah.
So, co-producer Kip Oman?
Yeah.
All right, cool name. Approached screenwriter Charles Edward Pogue with the idea of remaking The Fly in the early 80s. Now, Pogue read the original short story and watched the original film as he had never actually seen it before. And this was something that he found out he was interested in. Now, from a video that I saw him talking about it, he actually said that he enjoyed what he saw, but he noticed that in the old film, what ends up happening is there's two beings that go in and out. And then one has a fly with a human head, and one has a human body with a fly head. And he noticed that when they finally split, though, the main character was pulled out. And in the whole film was just kind of like
weird.
About the wife dealing with it. And he felt like that was kind of boring. So if he was going to do it, he was going to take a different approach to it. Although his screenplay ended up being somewhat faithful to the original, just in terms of tone and things like that.
Yeah.
Story-wise, though, he had a lot of the blueprint that would come out to be this particular film. So Stuart Cornfield signed on to the idea, and the two pitched the concept to 20th Century Fox. Pogue was paid to write the first draft of the screenplay. Unfortunately, it was fucking garbage. Exactly. This is one of those scenarios where everybody's like, hot potato. Yeah. Fuck this. This is yours. Is yours.
Yeah, totally.
Executives of the projects hated it and immediately withdrew. But thanks to some woody negotiation on Cornfield's part, they were able they were able to get a deal with Fox where they would distribute the film if they can get funding from an outside source. The funding was actually done via Mel Brooks, who signed on to produce the film along with the company Brooks Films. Cornfeld worked with Brooks frequently, and they were friends. The two actually also worked on the David Lynch film, The Elephant Man, down the line at some point. Now, it's interesting because when I was looking at this too, when it comes to the Mel Brooks involvement, he actually only read the first part of the script, and he's like, why did you send this bullshit to me? I don't want to... This is stupid. And then the writer actually said, just read the rest of the script, Mel. He's like, yeah, fucking fine.
Right.
He had this very keen idea that he was a fucking genius, and he's like, I'm always right, so don't question me, but I'll read the rest of it. And he ended up loving it and signing on immediately. Yeah. So that goes to show that the story itself was strong. It's just
there were parts that were severely lacking.
Yes. Well, that's exactly what Mel Brooks said. He's like, it needs to be revamped, but you have something here.
Yeah.
So... Now, the new funding via Mel Brooks. Brooks read the script and agreed it needed work. The script was passed along to Walton Green, who edited the draft. Upon its return to Brooks, it was decided that the draft was once again a step in the wrong direction. And it was actually sent back to Pogue to make some edits. Now, that's got to be a shitty job.
So, again, hot potato.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's literally, like, they're trying so hard to make these edits to this film, and it's just not going.
No.
Like, they have this idea, but executing it, they're just, like, they're fucking hitting a wall.
Nobody's got it down.
Yeah,
nobody understands it, what is going to make it good. But there's something good underneath. Now, well, editing was kind of a clusterfuck. Our buddies Brooks and Cornfeld were trying to find somebody to direct this fucking movie. Their first choice was David Cronenberg, but at the time he was working on Total Recall for Dino De
Laurentiis.
And he was out of the running. He wasn't able to accept.
He was working.
Yeah, and which is interesting because he wouldn't end up doing that anyways. But they decided on a young British up-and-coming director, Robert Bierman, after seeing one of his short films. And Bierman was actually flown to L.A., to meet Pogue, and the film was in very early stages of pre-production when Bierman got a really fucked up call.
Yeah.
Where his young daughter ended up dying in a farming accident in South Africa, and he had to pull out.
So, yeah, this is super fucked up. Like, so, like, they pulled out, and of course everyone was really understanding, and they were just we'll call us, you know, and, like, kind of went back and forth where he was, like, saying that he was willing to come back, he just needed a couple months, and then once those couple of months were up, he called, and he was just like, I can't do this.
His heart wasn't it? He specifically said, I just can't, man. Like, my heart's not fucking there. This is a bad situation.
Yeah, it was just a bad time.
And if you see him talk before that, he's so excited about the film. He's just like, I'm going to make one of the best films ever. I get to do this concept.
Yeah.
Like, he was fucking hyped, but then, you know.
Obviously, death.
Shit happens, yeah.
But, yeah, so.
Now, Cornfeld caught wind that Cronenberg was actually no longer associated with Total Recall due to some creative differences with the producers there. And he asked him one more time about The Fly, to which Cronenberg was like, fuck yeah, I'm gonna do this. So, however, he had a condition that he had the opportunity to rewrite the script and just take it from there. It's very interesting stuff. So for a few of the differences, though, Miss Webster, take it away.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've all seen the movie, so I'm not going to go over the plot of the movie because we've seen the fucking movie. Mm-hmm. In Pogue's draft, the script actually focused on a married couple called Jeff and Barbara Powell, who are a happily married couple. And the Stathis type character was a family friend named either Philip DeWitt or Harry Chandler. So so right off the bat, it's a completely different couple.
Yeah.
And then towards the end, you know, it's a very similar plot line, you know, very similar. But then Jeff traps himself in one of the teleportation booths just as Barb arrives to watch him kill and destroy the teleporter with the intent all along. So basically, it's the same exact thing except for Jeff somehow manages to destroy himself in the process.
Okay, it's a little more, I guess, standard. Like, the monster's dead and blah, blah, blah.
It's much more of a standard linear storyline.
Linear story, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Okay, good, yes. But Cronenberg made his own changes. He ended up retooling a lot of the stuff.
And we got the thing, whatchamacallit, the script.
The script.
That we know and love today.
Now, from what I was looking up, he made major changes to the dialogue and the characterizations of the character.
Right.
But he credits Pogue with, like, the structure. He's like, I would not have been able to make this film without the foundation that Pogue built. There's no way this could have came up. And they originally wanted him to have full credit. But with a script that has resounding approval, Cronenberg demanded that Pogue actually share this credit with him. And which is, again, it's a move for somebody in Hollywood to do. That's pretty fucking bold. That's nice.
Yeah, no, I actually gave mad props to Cronenberg for this.
Respect. Yeah. Honestly, that's awesome.
Super.
Based off the histories we read, fucking gay. Like, way to go.
Yeah.
He's the anti-Kevin Williams. So. But with all this, they began casting the film. Now, the first choice for the lead was actually John Malkovich, which would have been fucking interesting. but he didn't want to take on the project, as he was kind of worried about the sheer amount of makeup that would be required to shoot.
He didn't want to sit in a chair for 7 hours.
Fucking lazy ass. Now, from what I saw, they were given a list of available actors. One of the makeup artists was like, listen, just give me somebody with a small nose and little ears. I can work with that. But in the list, they saw Jeff Goldblum's things popping up. And they're like, wait a second. Can we get Jeff Goldblum? Is he available for this? The makeup guy's like, fuck, dude. His ears and nose are fucking gigantic. There's no way. But you know what? We'll make it work. That was actually the one sentence he said. It's like, we will make it work.
If you get Jeff Goldblum, we will make it work.
Exactly.
You make it work for Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, he's worth the fucking extra 2 hours. You're like, now we got to cast the nose. Okay, cool.
Great.
So Cronenberg and Kornfeld fought hard to cast Jeff as Seth Brundle against the wishes of the president of 20th Century Fox, Larry Gordon, who eventually did give in, but his last words in this whole scenario was, it's their mistake to make. So he didn't have faith in this shit at all.
Which, like, joke's on you, fucker.
Yeah, you Jeff Goldblum is fucking synonymous with this film, even beyond the 50s.
So, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Larry Gordon, suck a dick, man. Sorry.
Well, here's the thing, though. It's like, when I imagine The Fly, I don't imagine the original. Like, when someone's like, oh, yeah, The Fly, like, the remake, I thought that meant that they did a remake of the 1986 version. And
yeah,
I
was exactly.
like, they did a remake of that? But it is the remake. Like, it's able to stand alone. And I think that's what makes it so... It sets it apart from other sequels because it totally stands alone as its own film.
It almost has... It's just conceptually tied. I mean, I had to look up and realize and learn Vincent Price was in the other one.
Right.
Like, I know Jeff Goldblum's in this shit, and I seen it for the first time like a day ago.
Right.
So, but then with Goldblum came Gina Davis, who they were actually dating at the time, and then she was cast to play Veronica. Their chemistry in the movie was due to their real-life relationship that they would... have and then go on to live in posterity, even with the couple getting married a year after the film's release. However, they did divorce in 1990.
Gina Davis has been married 4 times and is currently single.
That's crazy.
I know. Gina Davis, I love you.
But, God, dude, Gina Davis in her prime, she can get married however the fuck time she wants.
It's true. Like, and she's great.
I mean, years later, she would do Thelma and Louise, and she's still...
Thelma and Louise is one of my favorite movies of all time.
I love that. Ridley Scott directed that movie.
Yeah, it's a great fucking movie.
The director of Alien.
Yeah. It's a great movie.
It is. And Gina Davis is wonderful as always. But with alternate stuff, can we get some information from Miss Alex Webster here? What's up?
Yeah. So I wanted to go over some of the deleted and alternate scenes, because something that a lot of people don't realize is that in 2005, a extended edition Blu-ray version came out, and it came out with all the deleted scenes and extended versions that we hadn't seen before due to... honestly, the graphic nature that is known only in Cronenberg films.
It was the test screenings, right?
Right.
They fucked it up.
So, after filming ended earlier than expected in 1986, a rough cut was shown to Fox executives who were impressed, but when preview showings were made to the general population, the people had a very strong, very negative reaction to the graphic nature of some of, honestly, the most iconic scenes in the movie that we still talk about. Several scenes had been cut from the movie in order to make Seth Brundle a more likable character, because he does some shifty shit later in the movie that sort of makes people, like, it turns people off, you know, from him.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Although I will attest that test audiences, guys, are fucking idiots sometimes.
Sometimes,
they just are.
Yeah, no, I agree. But very on par with Cronenberg, The Fly was edited heavily to keep a strong pace and cut the worst parts out of gore. The final cut running only about 95 minutes.
It's perfect length, honestly.
It's a great...
It's perfect.
Perfect. Yeah, because I have a very shitty attention span, so... So ultimately, only a few full scenes were cut out completely, and many only getting trimmed down. DVD and Blu-ray editions can be found that show the deleted, extended, and alternate footage for the film, which we will go into now.
Yay!
A few of the most notable and alternate scenes include a second interview between Veronica and Seth after his superhuman exercise scene where he's, like, doing all the, like, you know, he's, like, flipping around and shit.
The only time where transformation is happy.
Yeah. where he theorizes that his teleportation has improved him in some way. We see this in the film, but it's significantly shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much later when he's, like, going a little crazy.
I mean, this is probably just, they're, like, too much exposition, I would imagine. Like, we get it. We get it now.
We get it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the monkey cat scene. So, this is fucking disgusting.
Did you see it?
No.
I saw it. It's online.
I haven't watched it.
Oh, we'll get into it right now. Just explain what's in there. I'll show you.
Okay, so a legendary and infamous scene where Seth, in a particularly gruesome transitional makeup stage that is only seen in this scene, uses his telepod to merge a random alley cat and the surviving baboon together to find a cure. However, the monkey cat creature that comes out is horrifyingly deformed and in horrible pain. The two-headed creature attacks Brundle, who he has to beat it to death with a metal pipe. Brundle, who is super fucked up by this, goes scaling his lab where he sprouts a leg or a fly leg out of his side, and he chews it off with his teeth.
Yeah, and
it's disgusting.
It's funny because I was watching it last night with one of my friends and my roommate in our big ass fucking projector, and we all were like, what the fuck happened to the baboon? He was in half the film and he just left.
That's one of the things that I didn't put in here, but it was also noted that people were kind of confused, but unfortunately, because the scene had to be cut, it did cut out, you know, what happens to the second baboon,
that
because he
resolution.
Just vanishes.
Yeah, the brother baboon.
yeah, and it turns into a plot hole for sure. Yeah. But unfortunately, it's either gruesome monkey cat or tiny plot hole.
Now, the scene itself is... It's actually really fucked up. Like, when I watched it, I was like, oh, that's up there with the worst parts of the film. Because the monkey cat itself is... The scream is fucking blood-curdling.
Yeah,
like,
that's
it's
why
fucked
I don't
want
to watch it.
But it's funny, though. Because one more thing that actually in the script, when they were going to shoot this, they had one other section. You know how he spits out the saliva stuff?
The digestive enzymes? Yes.
Yes. Immediately after the scene, they were supposed to shoot him doing it to a random woman walking by. And he was going to pull her into an alley and spit on her. And as he was going to start getting ready to eat her, he would have a change of heart.
And just leave her?
And just leave her. When she's all scalded and, like, stops twitching kind of thing.
Yikes.
But they thought that was so bad, they didn't even bother shooting it. They're like, you know what? We're actually just going to cut this part because that's a lot of money. And we're just not going to make the film. It's not going to make the film. That's fucked up.
Yeah, for sure.
But the scene itself, oof. If you can, guys, it's on YouTube. And after you've seen The Fly, I recommend you check it out because it's just more of this. It's classic Cronenberg, man. It's fucking classic.
I might have to watch it, but I really don't want to.
The thing looks fucking gross.
I didn't want to watch the last 30 minutes of the film.
That's brutal.
We'll get into it.
Yes.
So, some more alternate scenes is there are about five different endings to this film.
Yeah, there's quite a bit.
Yeah. So, there's the butterfly baby epilogue, which has four different options.
It's like a choose your own adventure. What, do you want to go in the clock tower, or do you want to save your friends at the graveyard?
Bye, motherfucker. No.
I'm going to switch to page 34, all right? Yeah, graveyard, fuck you.
I know, I was so bad at those. I just...
Skip ahead. Yeah.
Anyway. So, the butterfly baby epilogue. So, Veronica and Stathis end up together and married sometime after Brundle's death. She wakes up from a nightmare where she had given birth to Seth's kid, and Stathis assures her that she's safe, and the baby she's pregnant with now is his, which heavily implies that she had an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Veronica falls asleep and dreams of a human baby with butterfly wings hatching from a cocoon and flies towards some light source.
I actually saw this one.
Okay.
Yeah.
How was it?
It almost seems CG-ish, honestly. Even though it's not. It's really weird.
All right.
The little baby, though, actually, it's very elegant looking. It's not gruesome at all.
I figured.
Yeah.
They probably wanted to add it on, like, a lighter note.
Yeah.
But Veronica and Stathis... The other one is Veronica and Stathis are in bed. She isn't pregnant, but still has the butterfly baby dream. Another one Veronica wakes up in her own bed alone and falls asleep and has the butterfly baby dream. She is still pregnant with Brundle's baby.
Man, they were covering all the options.
Yeah. And then the last one is Veronica wakes up alone in her own bed. Then she has the butterfly baby dream. In this final version, she is not visibly pregnant, which leaves the ending open to interpretation.
Hmm. Interesting.
None of those versions were used because it raised more questions than answers, and test audiences were so fucked up by the rest of the movie that they didn't really care about a happy or hopeful ending.
That's accurate. That's fucking accurate. Jesus.
Plus, the chemistry between Brundle and Ronnie were so good that test audiences kind of insinuated that no one wanted her to end up with Stathis.
Yeah, I agree.
Because, the whole time, even though he's, like, a fucking fly man, like, mm-hmm. I'm still kind of, like, rooting for them, you know?
And then, I mean, Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum are actually fucking, so. Yeah. Chemistry's there.
The chemistry's definitely there. But, yeah, so filmmakers also agreed that the story needed to end with Veronica mercy killing Brundle at the end of the movie, regardless of the unanswered questions about the unborn baby, so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Makes total sense.
Yeah. And I think they made the right choice with the ending.
It's kind of perfect.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you don't need more after that. Mm-mm. No, and I'll give you a fucking...
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. But several climaxes of the film went through adjustments in various drafts before the final version was filmed. So once again, we have some more possible endings.
Mm.
So, Veronica is unconscious after Brundlefly throws her into Telepod 1. When Brundlepod emerges from the prototype Telepod, the creature crawls towards Stathis, who grabs the loose wire and electrocutes Brundlefly, who then liquefies.
That's such an 80s ending right there. That's how yes. You kill Jason right there. It's the same shit.
Number two. Same exact thing, except with Brundlepod crawls at Stathis, it is undetermined if it's an attack or just desperation, and he just dies.
He just croaks right there in front of him.
He just dies.
Hmm. That's a defeatist kind of ending. I can see that being used.
Ending number three. 2005 DVD... version. Veronica is conscious when the Brundlepod emerges and crawls towards her, where she aims Stathis's shotgun at it and the creature dies at her feet. This was eventually changed to the mercy killing we see in the film.
These are all just inferior enough to the actual ending.
Yeah.
Because him grabbing the shotgun, I was like, ooh. It actually affected me kind of deep.
I was really upset. I was like, oh no, because I also know it's Jeff Goldblum in there.
Yeah, he's right. Even though it looks completely different, still like, they built us to this.
Yeah.
And you're just going to fucking pop him? You know what? Actually pop him. Yes, he needs to be popped.
Yeah, he needs to be popped.
He needs to be popped.
And now, Mr. Fuentes.
All right, let's see. You guys want to learn about those effects, though, huh?
Yeah, so we've been talking about the special effects. We are going to tell you a thing or two about the special effects.
And the first thing you should know is this bitch won an Academy Award for Best Makeup, and deservedly so.
Right?
The makeup was designed, executed by Chris Wallace, who would actually, again, he'd go on to direct the second Fly, and it was done over the period of 3 months. The final Brundlefly creature was designed first, and then the versions that were used to transform Seth Brundle to his final incarnation were created afterwards. So they had that baseline to aim towards.
Yeah, which is a great way to really properly emphasize, the transformation.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's a good guiding principle right
there. Yeah, it's a good way to start at the worst and work your way back.
It's funny because they did this with Rocky also. When they did the final fight, they're like, we're going to start off. You guys both fucked up.
And we're just going to gradually...
We'll shoot backwards and then remove makeup as it goes. And to know exactly where we need to show the hits in that. So it actually worked out really well.
That's really interesting. That's a good way to do it.
Right? Smart filmmakers, man. So some of these guys are geniuses, honestly. The transformations were meant to be a metaphor for the aging process, with stuff like losing hair, teeth, fingernails, shit like that. His skin gradually becomes more discolored and lumpy. The intention was of the filmmakers to give Brundle a bruised and cancerous look that gets worse and worse as the film goes on. So it's highly metaphorical in that sense. But then, of course, the visualization of it is accurate. It's really fucked
Definitely.
Up.
Definitely.
Especially the teeth. Jesus.
I actually had a nightmare last night that I was losing my teeth.
Oh, dude. I can see that. It's nightmare-inducing, this fucking film. Yeah.
I haven't been sleeping very well,
mm-hmm.
so I've been working on this episode in lieu of sleep, which is not a good idea.
So thank you, Alex.
I'm fine.
Yeah, you're just... I'm not, not a giant worker or anything, you know?
No, I'm not a shell of a person right now. I'm fine. No, but no, when I was working on this episode, because I couldn't fucking turn my brain off, I was like, I don't want to go to sleep because I'm genuinely worried that I'm going to have a nightmare about this. Like,
yeah.
I never did, thank God. But, like, I was really worried. I was just like, I don't want to have a fucking Brundlefly nightmare. Like, I really, really don't.
Oh my gosh, you merged with Gimli?
You know what that reminds me of? That Full Metal Alchemist episode.
Oh, I never watched Full Metal Alchemist.
I'm gonna fucking kill you.
I know. It's fucked up.
Okay, anyone who listens who's watched Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood knows exactly what I'm talking about when I say a human dog hybrid. It's fucked up. And body horror.
Okay, alright, you know, I've heard good things about this anime. I just gotta find.
It's on Netflix. You have
that's,
no excuse.
That's how you shame anyone into watching something. Like, by the way, piece of shit, it's on Netflix. Oh, you mean I can do this whenever? Okay.
That means you have no excuse.
Yeah, no excuse. No, it's true. I don't. Not at all.
Anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
The various looks were tested for makeup effects. Some of the early test footage can actually be found on the 2005 DVD Collector's Edition. I actually seen these two.
Oh, okay, cool.
It's kind of funny seeing Jeff Goldblum not act like the fly, but be in the fly costume. So he'll stop and be like in his little fucking points.
I love him so much.
Yeah, but he's doing his like regular human Jeff Goldblum thing, but with this thick fucking makeup on. It's awesome.
Oh yeah, with like a fucking fly on.
Yeah, just like, ooh. Like, just like, ooh. Can my assistant get me some coffee, please? Can I?
It's like, that was good Jeff Goldblum.
I think I have Jeff Goldblum tendencies in my normal life sometimes, but
I can just see that.
Not as brilliant as that. Mm-mm. Man. But the transformation was actually broken up into 7 different stages, with Goldblum spending many hours in the makeup chair for Bundle's later incarnations.
Oh yeah, I can fucking imagine.
Now, stage 1 and 2. Very, very simple. Subtle rash, skin a little discolored. Lead this with weird facial sores. It gets kind of a weird look. You see it for, I think, the most amount of time in the beginning of the film. It's when he's doing exposition, basically. He's got tiny little fly hairs kind of protruding out of his face here and there. They're sporadic. That's stage 1, of course. And in addition to the patch of butterfly hairs growing out of a wound that he gets on his back. Or butterfly. Fly hairs. Yeah.
I was like, he is not a fucking butterfly.
He's definitely not tying a fucking butterfly. which is funny because when he gets the wound, it's like that little chip that he goes on. They never explain the microchip. It's just in his bed.
You know, and it's just a scientist doing scientist things with a computer chip. Which, like... Ow.
You're like, yeah, that's valuable. I guess although, it's right there.
In his defense, last night I did roll over on a, I was sewing a dress and I stuck a needle into the thread, in the, like, the spool of thread, and I rolled over onto it and I was like, what the fuck is poking me? And I looked at it and it was a fucking, like, the end of a needle. Like, not the pointy end. Like, it's still sharp, but not, like, the pointy end.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, what the fuck is this doing here? Toss.
It's like,
so, in his defense, for those of us who do have hobbies, that can happen.
I've actually also had that happen with a lady's earring that she lost.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I'm just, like, turning over, like, what the fuck? Oh, that's it. That's the thing. And I actually ended up trying to get it and kicked it. And then it just fell off again.
You dick.
Not on purpose. Whatever. It was tired, like, just, oh, what is the fuck? Oh, is that the thing?
That's an earring. Yeah. Whoops.
Sorry, lady. that's mean. But stage 3 and 4A. The piecemeal process covering Goldblum's face and later his feet, arms, and torso. Wig and bald spots and crooked prosthetic teeth were all added in these stages.
Mm-hmm.
Now, stage 4B is interesting because this is, of course, seen in the deleted scene, the monkey cat scene. If you haven't seen the film, you haven't seen this particular stage of makeup. And I will actually say this is the strongest makeup job, I think, of 4B? The stages. Because it's the most Goldblum-like.
But still grotesque.
But still grotesque, because you know how in the stage before this, he obviously his skin's fully covered and all fucked up and everything, but he can still wear clothes, right?
Yeah.
This one, he can't wear the clothes, but he's still lanky, skinny Goldblum, but you see things just protruding out of him. It looks like the Thing from Fantastic Four. But yeah, it's during the monkey cat scene that was deleted and required Goldblum to wear the first of two full-body foam latex suits, as Brundle has stopped wearing clothing, of course, at that point in the story. Jeez. Now, stage five was the second full-body suit, and that was the one with the very exaggerated deformities, which also required Goldblum to wear contact lenses that made one eye look larger than the other. So it's like almost complete fly transformation at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when she goes back to him and was like trying to get out the "I have your baby," but she couldn't get it out.
Right.
He's like very gruesome and trollish looking like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is that stage five that you actually see probably the second most out of all of them. Now, the six is the final Brundle fly creature.
Is stage five where his teeth falls out?
Yes.
Okay.
Stage five is where the teeth comes out. And then stage three would be the nails coming off. Yeah. And then four is right in between. It is, guys. I mean, you've obviously seen the film if you're listening to this show. If you haven't, watch this bitch right away. It's when we release this episode, it'll be off Hulu, so you're going to have to find it.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, it gets off December 1st. I know. Fucked up. All.
See, we dodged a bullet.
We did.
Right. Watch the fucking episode.
For real.
Although, if it's going to be taken off of Hulu, that means it's probably going to be re-added back to Netflix.
Yeah, either Netflix or Amazon. It goes to either one of those, typically. Because it's one of those movies that gets cycled around.
Yeah, I've definitely seen it on Netflix, and I watched it on Hulu, so it's there.
Nice. Yeah, no. And the Hulu was actually... I'll talk about that later. But the final Brundlefly creature, referred to as the space bug by the film's crew, was depicted in various full-body cable and rod-controlled puppets that it was... It's the full fly transformation, basically, where he's coming out the skin and all that
stuff. Is this where, like, his jaw comes off?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's when he's losing, basically, the suit from stage five to become stage six.
Well, at this point, it's not Jeff Goldblum.
No, it's the animatronics at this point. Yeah, so he didn't have to wear shit. That's why, when we said earlier, only one of two bodysuits when it came to that, because no need for bodysuits once you're a fly. Now... another puppet was made, which represented the mortally injured Brundlefly telepod fusion. Yes, the Brundlepod, or initially dubbed the Brundle Booth, and then the Brundle Thing by the crew. But yeah, this is when, at the end of the film, you see him crawling out.
This is so sad.
It sucks because, like, he's fused with an inanimate object, and you're seeing metal infused with flesh, and it's fucking gross.
Yeah, again, very Cronenberg.
Very Cronenberg,
This part is integral to body horror and Cronenberg's type of thing. Like, if for those of you who don't know, he also directed Crash, which, very similar type thing, with, like, the melding of bodies and...
Not the Michael Pena Crash.
No, not
that piece of shit. Although I love Michael Pena, but not that piece of shit.
No. This one is completely different. For those of you who don't know, it's about people who have a fetish for car accidents.
Yeah, they're like...
They fuck and then crash cars. They fuck in crashing cars. Like, it's really weird. But that whole idea of, like, metal and flesh and, like, all of that, like, it's very Cronenberg, and it gives me the heebie fucking jeebies.
Yeah, no, it is. And funny thing enough is it's actually really similar to one of the, again, as we talked about Perfect Blue before, the Cone's fucking, his fucking teacher, Otombo, did Akira. Akira pulls a lot of this kind of stuff with body horror in terms of flesh.
I'm gonna talk about that later.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
All right, fuck it then. We're done.
I have a whole section about it in the body horror section. You ruined my fucking thunder.
But with all that information, let's go ahead and see how this film was actually acclaimed, which Miss West is gonna tell you guys all about that shit.
So this, this is my ship now. I kind of, the rest of this is all me.
Yeah,
so.
I'm here to absorb and just let the cards fall where they be.
So the reception and legacy. Upon its release, the film was critically acclaimed, with praise mainly being directed at the special effects as well as Jeff Goldblum's performance in the film, which we mentioned earlier.
Totally fucking deserved, yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, very well deserved. I don't think anyone was a shitty actor in this film.
No, hell no. Nobody was.
It was very well acted.
Even stupid John Getz character, Stathis.
Yeah, he also John Getz also just gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah.
He has a creepy face.
You know what, though?
He looks handsy.
That's a good fucking description. But I mean, if you could convincingly play a piece of shit, you know, as much as I don't like the character, you connect, son. You mm-hmm. got it. It's You're true. Good.
I'm sure John Getz is a great person, but yeah. like his face just.
Ah. But he shouldn't be allowed in schools. You're right.
Anyway, so despite The Fly being a very gory remake of a classic film made by a controversial non-mainstream director, the film was a commercial success, the biggest of Cronenberg's career at that point, and it was the top grossing film in the U.S. for 2 weeks.
Dude, number one at two? For 2 weeks?
Yeah.
That's for a body horror film? Jesus.
For a Cronenberg film?
Dude.
Yeah. Oh. The graphic creature effects and tragic love story was a perfect storm for strong audience reactions, and word of the film spread quickly.
Yeah, I can see that. I tell people about this as I was around.
Yeah. So a fun fact, Cronenberg initially got some questions about the treatment of Brundle and how many people interpreted the beginning stage of his transformation, to say the least, to be reminiscent of Kaposi's sarcoma, which is the most notably visible type of skin cancer that was heavily impacting those dying of AIDS in the early 80s.
Oh, that's fucking fascinating.
Yeah, which is what I thought, actually, when I watched it, because... As I mentioned before, I have a gender degree studies.
Oh, right. So you've actually probably seen photos and stuff of
yeah,
this
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I've taken classes on, like, the AIDS crisis.
Damn.
Yeah. It was a fucked up, it was emotionally draining quarter, to say the least.
Yeah. That I've done, tried to do research, and I get so far enough where I'm like, you know, I don't actually have to see the pictures. Like, I'm good.
Yeah, no. It's intense. But the point is, Kaposi's sarcoma, it's basically very similar to stage one, where you're getting, like, the lesions, and, like, you just look ill. So so many people felt that way on a mass scale that people began to believe that the movie, instead of being a metaphor for death and dying or the aging process, it was a metaphor for HIV/AIDS.
Specifically, right?
Specifically.
Yeah.
Cronenberg eventually denied this and said he was going for the metaphor on aging and dying. But essays have been written about interpretations of the film from an HIV/AIDS standpoint to cocaine use. Like, people interpret this film in many different ways.
Well, I remember Cronenberg actually saying in an interview too, it was just like, if people see AIDS in the thing, I know my film's successful because it's a general about the AIDS progression and disease, so if they find their niche in there, then the movie's for them. But it's meant to be broad.
So the quote is, if you or your lover has AIDS, you watch that film. This is a Cronenberg quote, by the way. If you or your lover has AIDS, you watch that film, and of course you'll see AIDS in it. But you don't have to have that experience to respond emotionally to the movie, and I think that's really its power. It's not to say that AIDS didn't have an incredible impact on everyone, and of course, after a certain point, people were seeing AIDS stories everywhere, so I don't take any offense that people see that in my movie. For me, though, there was something about The Fly story that was much more universal. Aging and death, something that all of us have to deal with.
I don't like thinking about that, Cronenberg. Come on, man.
I know. Like, this, like, doing research for this, like, I had to, like, take a couple, like, self-care breaks because it's very easy to give, like, to give myself existential anxiety.
Yeah. Cronenberg's the full... he doesn't shy away.
No.
Yeah, he doesn't.
I mean, you could say that, I mean, making films are, like, it's his way of coping with it.
Yeah, that's true. That's a very good... Because you have to cope with it,
at some way. Right. I was talking to my brother about this, because one of his friends, like, basically how she processes death and dying. She's an artist, and she does these really cool time designs. And I was just like, yeah, why do you think I record myself talking for 2 hours every week? Like,
right? No, it gives me a drive that
I need. Yeah,
it's funny, though, because... was it the Flat Earth people? They talk about, like, the expansion of the universe and, like, existentialism and how kind of, like, nothing really matters. To them, it, like, freaks them out. They're like, well, we believe in this stuff because it's organized and it gives us a sense of purpose.
Yeah.
If we had to believe in that stuff, then we'd just be fucking miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. Flat Earthers are an interesting breed.
Yes.
But also,
some people combat this with that stupid philosophy, you know? People find their ways.
Whatever helps you sleep at night.
Yeah.
We do podcasts. Some people believe in a flat earth.
Just don't tell us about the flat earth, please. We're not pawns, guys.
Anyway, so moving on. Gene Siskel, a film critic, named The Fly the 10th best film of 1986.
Ooh.
So for a horror film and for a critic to say that is a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, especially in the 80s when horror was being just like
it was mainly,
shit on by critics.
It was also mainly campy slasher
exactly.
type stuff in the 80s. The Fly maintains an impressive 91% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which is a fun fact. Mm-hmm. To this day, the film still makes its rounds every year, appearing on lists of all kinds as one of the top horror films of all time. I had a whole list of different lists that it appeared on, mm-hmm. but just know that basically it also, what's interesting is that it appears on lists of all kinds, not just horror films.
Yeah.
Like, it also broke out of the horror barrier in the sense that it also appeared on, like, the top 50 films of all time. Because it's crazy. It's an effective story.
It is.
It's just horrifying.
I mean, it's as much science fiction as it is horror as well.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of those things where it's like, it's going to pull people from all over.
Mm-hmm.
If you can handle it. If you can handle it.
And that's the big if.
The big if, yes.
The quote, "Be afraid, be very afraid," was also used as the film's marketing tagline, and it became so ingrained in popular culture, as it and variants have appeared in countless films and TV series, that a large number of people who are familiar with the phrase are unaware that it originated with The Fly.
By the way, I learned that information right fucking now.
Yeah.
I totally did not know that. That's actually pretty cool.
I was about to ask, like, I was like, did you know that the like, be afraid, be very afraid.
No, see?
Was delivered by Gina Davis.
This is why I skip your sections of the thing, so I can learn this shit.
Yeah, but then you get ahead of yourself and cut into my stuff.
I fucked up.
I had a perfectly laid out...
Damn it.
I had a story.
But it's worth it to be surprised right there.
But yeah, so I thought that was really interesting because I didn't know that either. Like, when she said it in the film, I was just like, is this
It's just a line.
Yeah, but I thought it was like, yeah. But it's cool that they, like, it's a very good, effective marketing tagline.
No, that's true. It really is. And it sells, it's a good warning for the film, too. You mm-hmm. should be afraid watching this shit.
You fucking horrified. Yeah. To this day, most people involved with the production of the film say that Jeff Goldblum got stiffed for an Academy Award nomination that year due to older Academy voters and their history of not honoring horror. We fucking see you, the Academy, you shady bitch.
No, seriously, man. They didn't do it until Silence of the Lambs, right?
I think so, yeah. And Silence of the Lambs is arguably a psychological thriller.
I think it's more that, yeah.
Than a horror film.
But I mean, yeah, it's old fucks in the Academy.
However, it still won some awards, which I will go into now. It still won the aforementioned Academy Award in Best Makeup. The film was also nominated for a BAFTA, a Hugo Award, and Saturn Awards, where Jeff Goldblum, Chris Wallace, and the movie itself won Best Actor, Best Makeup, and Best Horror Film, respectively. Gina Davis and David Cronenberg were nominated for Best Actress and Best Director, but they didn't win.
I like how the Saturns are like the makeup awards. So yeah. It's like, hey, cool movies. We're going to give you an award because those guys fucking suck.
Yeah. Kind of not relevant, but still kind of relevant about, like, the legacy. Mm-hmm. There are a shit ton of sequels and ideas, but none of them are actually good.
No.
Or really reach the acclaim that The Fly did. Now, admittedly, this probably has something to do with the fact that Cronenberg has nothing to do with the sequels.
Mm-hmm.
Cronenberg actually admitted in 2012 that he wrote a sequel and would direct it if 20th Century Fox agreed to distribute it, but that hasn't happened as of 2018. Actually, it'll definitely never happen, as Cronenberg usually and pretty much sticks to this rule. He doesn't believe in sequels. He tells a story and it's done.
But he wrote.
He wrote it.
I know.
He wrote it, but that was his own, it was the exception to his own rule.
Yeah.
And 20th Century Fox has pretty much flat out said, no, we're not going to let you have another movie.
But he wrote it, 20th Century Fox. It's there.
I know.
Just fucking do it.
No, it's not going to happen.
Ugh,
I know. The funny thing is, Jeff Goldblum, on June 15th in 2018... the day after my birthday, Jeff Goldblum said that he would be interested in doing a sequel only if Cronenberg was involved, even though his character died. And he said this, I don't think my character would be...
No, you gotta say it like Jeff Goldblum.
I can't. Okay, do you want to... Okay.
I can try.
No, I'm not gonna do a Jeff Goldblum impression.
Come on. No, go for it.
Anyway, I don't think my character would be involved because, of course, I got tragically mutated with a fly and then the machine. Oh, boy. But maybe I show up as a grandchild of the original Seth Brundle. Or Seth Brundle had a brother that emerges in some ways. Who knows? I don't know. But David Cronenberg was a thrill to work with. Boy, if he was involved, I'd like to work with him again. I'll tell you that. Okay. I love Jeff Goldblum.
I do. Even reading it out loud, I can sense the Goldblum-isms all up in there. I'm gonna try to read it one time as Jeff Goldblum.
Okay.
I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna be like, let's see if it works. All right. I don't know, my character would be involved because, of course, I got tragically mutilated in The Fly and then the machine. Oh, boy. But I show up as a grandchild of the original Seth Brundle, or Seth Brundle had a brother that emerges in some way. Who knows? I don't know. But David Cronenberg was a thrill to work with. Boy, if he was, I'd work with him, I'll tell you that.
That was great.
Yes.
It was a little bit more manic than Jeff Goldblum, but I think you nailed it.
I think less coffee. I got this shit, dude. I got this shit.
That was actually really good.
Thank you.
Wow. Good job.
That was my contribution, guys. Just if you're not seeing me bow right now, because I can just tell you I'm bowing and we're actually just recording. But still, bow.
Good job.
Thank you. Ta-da.
There's your attaboy for the day.
Cronenberg Christmas.
Okay, so now it is my fucking moment, guys.
Ooh, get some analysis, son.
So, this is one of the things that I love about this podcast. Anthony is very technical and talks a lot about production and technical aspects of the film.
Mm-hmm.
My experience with film, specifically with horror film, is 1,000% theory-based.
Which is fun. Theory-based is fun, because horror has a lot of shit to pull from.
Yeah, it has a lot to talk about, and you can really work. There's a lot of material.
Well, I mean, it's also dark as fuck.
Yeah, it's
fun. Which helps.
Yeah, it's fun. So, that's what I work with. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about David Cronenberg and body horror. So, some keywords to keep in mind while we're talking about Cronenberg and body horror would be body horror, transformation, infection, technology, psychological versus physical.
The word infection always fucks with me, honestly.
Yeah. So, and it's a huge part. So, man, oh man. David Cronenberg and I go way back. So, here's a little bit about him. Cronenberg, for those of you who don't know, is a Canadian director who is particularly famous for his reality-bending, fucked-up films that focus on reality and transformations of the body. He specializes in a subset of horror that has come to be known as quote-unquote body horror,
mm-hmm.
a particularly graphic and upsetting form of horror. It's easily defined as a subgenre that intentionally showcases graphic or psychologically disturbing violations of the human body.
Ooh, violations. That's exactly it.
Yeah. Some examples would be aberrant sex, mutations, mutilation, zombification, gratuitous violence, disease, or unnatural body movements. All of these things are fucking squicky.
Yeah, and they're all Cronenberg is Cronenberg.
Yes. A side note, body horror is the only thing that really, truly fucks me up.
Me too.
Most things I can handle, but when it comes mm-hmm. to body horror in terms of, like, the reality bending, it really gets under my skin. I don't know why. I mean, it's effective.
Yeah, it's like an Uncanny Valley kind of thing.
Yeah, almost.
But with protrusion.
Yeah, or mutations are I'm pretty okay with. Disease is also fine. It's, I think it's mostly, the aberrant sex and unnatural body movements that I'm always just, like...
You're like, that's not supposed to happen, but it looks fucking real and like something I haven't envisioned before.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's truly unnatural body movements or, like, spasming and, like, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff that I'm just like, eek.
Oh, so you would hate that deleted scene then?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Monkey Cat is fucked up.
I know I would hate it. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. But body horror falls into one of the three gross, quote-unquote, genres of excess, which includes pornography and melodrama for completely different reasons.
Well, that's a spectrum. Jesus. How about exploitation? Does that fall in there too?
What does?
Exploitation.
No, that's kind of its own thing,
mm-hmm.
Because exploitation focuses, it's gruesome for gruesomeness sake.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. It doesn't have a thematic importance when it does it.
Yeah, I'll explain the difference between the two actually a little bit later.
Sweet. All
right. But film scholar Linda Williams talks about how the success of these body genres are often measured by the degree to which the audience sensation mimics what is seen on screen.
That's why we're fucked.
Examples: feelings of terror through horror, sympathy through melodrama, or sexual arousal through pornography. Body horror specifically focuses on the limits and transformative capabilities of the human body.
Terror through horror, sympathy through melodrama, or sexual arousal through pornography. That's my Friday right there.
Very nice. Thank you. Thank you, Anthony.
I'll be here all week.
But body horror will often overlap with, but has distinct characteristics from other horror subgenres. For example, elements of mutilation can be common in slasher, splatter, or monster horror, but frequently differ in message and intent. A common difference in the body horror genre is that violations or distortions of the body are rarely the result of immediate or initial violence. Instead, they are generally marked by a loss of conscious control over the body through mutation, disease, or other tropes involving uncontrolled transformation.
That's actually a really apt point right there. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. I'll be here all week.
But, like, the difference in their approach to yes. mutilation is, yeah, it's disturbing when it's like, oh, it's out of your element. That's why mm-hmm. that happened to you. When this, it's like, no, this is a part of you now, and you're fucked.
It's the psychological impact of basically something happening to you that you can't control. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is based on control, and I think that's why a lot of it makes me so uncomfortable, is because yeah. there's that loss of control that happens, specifically with body horror, yeah. versus something like slasher horror or, what'd you
like
say?
Supernatural kind of stuff?
No.
Exploitation. Yeah.
Where it's something is happening to you, mm-hmm. you are not happening to yourself.
Hey, happening to yourself, yes, that's... Ooh. You having a Merry Christmas, y'all?
When I tell you this is my shit, yeah. like, I mean it. But yeah, so the genre can invoke intense feelings of physical or psychological disgust, or quote-unquote squick.
Squick,
as it's called. Something squicky.
Mm-hmm.
And it plays on anxieties around physical vulnerability. So, some common tropes specific to body horror as a subgenre include invasion, contagion, mutation, transformation, disease, mutilation, and other unnatural or violent distortions of the human body.
Mutilation always is the one that gets me, because that's like...
Infection. You also said infection.
Well, no, infection for sure, but mutilation is like, there's no going back.
Yeah.
That's the part that
yeah,
I'm
yeah,
like,
you're
ooh.
Fucked. But yeah. David Cronenberg is considered a principal originator of body horror via his earlier films like Shivers, 1975, and Rabbit, 1977. However, earlier examples of the body horror genre came from the 1950s American horror, such as The Blob and the original The Fly, both of which set the standard for the genre due to the film's focus on body mutilation and visceral special effects.
I know that's interesting, because I saw clips from the original mm-hmm. Fly, and it does look a little weird.
It like, has that transformation aspect to it. Same thing with The Blob, where mm-hmm. something is happening to you, and it becomes you. So you're happening to yourself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the character that has the bug head, the fly head.
Yes.
Like, there's an uncanny valiness to
absolutely,
it,
because
he
yeah.
moves so fucking humanly.
And that's why there's that... like squickiness to it, because mm-hmm. you're not used to seeing a fly head on a human body.
Oh,
you know,
those poor 50s audiences too,
right?
To them, they're just like, this is Cronenberg for us.
Yeah. So, fun fact, body horror is huge in Japanese horror, so this shit will be important later.
Okay, we
will bring this up again. It's widely represented in contemporary media such as anime, Katsushiro Otomo, mm-hmm. as we've discussed earlier. See Perfect Blue for more information. In the 1988 film Akira is a perfect example of body horror within anime. The film uses the genre to explore the adolescent body as a site of metamorphosis that could be considered monstrous. If this interests you at all, this is my book recommendation
okay,
of the week.
Okay.
Please see The Monstrous Feminine by Barbara Creed for more information about body horror and body talk. It talks a lot about one of Cronenberg's other films called The Brood, mm-hmm. which focuses specifically on it's based off of his ex-wife, which was very funny.
Okay, I have to watch this shit now.
You may or may not like it. It's very weird. It's kind of gross. It focuses around like pregnancy and birth.
Okay, I'll consider it now.
Yeah, it's kind of gross.
But what was that book again, Miss Alex Webster? What was that?
The Monstrous Feminine by Barbara Creed.
The Monstrous Feminine by Barbara Creed. Y'all remember that if you want to dive a little deeper into this shit.
Oh, and what an apt thing to make, because there is a lot of vagina talk in it.
Okay, all right. If y'all like vaginas.
So it talks about, like, teeth and, like, you know the movie Teeth?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
I'm aware of the movie Teeth.
They talk about that. They talk about, like, Carrie, The Brood. Like, it's, like, very dark. Yeah, it's really interesting. I read it several times. But anyway, Cronenberg went on to write, direct, and produce Dead Ringers immediately after this. So it came out in 1988, after The Fly, and it is easily one of the most disturbing films I have ever seen.
I've never seen Dead Ringers.
Dead Ringers has Jeremy Irons playing identical twins who are also gynecologists.
Oh, Jesus.
And they come up with gross gynecological instruments and torture, and they're both also simultaneously sleeping with the same woman. She thinks they're one person, though.
So you're saying for Cronenberg Christmas next year, we're watching fucking Dead Ringers.
I don't know, because I've never been able to finish it.
Ooh, so you're saying we're doing a play-by-play next year?
We'll see. You might not like it, because it has needles in it.
Okay, we're not doing it. We're not doing it. Fuck that.
See? Haha. But it easily, yeah, so it's one of the most disturbing films I've ever seen. I wrote about it for a class that I took, mm-hmm. and I was just like, I watched it in the library.
Please nobody walk by me while I'm watching this movie.
Yeah, I was in a library room, because I booked a library room, because it had mm-hmm. TVs at my university, and I hooked my laptop up to it, and I was in the far corner of the library.
Good.
And I was like, no one walk by me, please.
Somebody pulls a book from the shelf behind you, like, oh, putting that back.
Exactly. But yeah, so The Dead Zone, 1983, so a little bit before, mm-hmm. Based on Stephen King's novel of the same name, is to this day the scariest movie my mom has ever seen.
Really?
My mom, I asked her her favorite scary movie.
Okay.
And she doesn't like horror at all. And she's like, you know what? I saw, what was the Stephen King flick? The Dead Zone. I saw that when I was younger and it scared the shit out of me. And I didn't know David Cronenberg directed this until I was doing research for this episode.
Is that the one with Keith or Sutherland?
Yes.
Dang. I actually heard a lot of people saying some good shit about that one.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, interesting. Well, fans, if you have any opinions about The Dead Zone, let us know.
Well, also, you know, Stephen King is also on our list because we like to pay our homages to Stephen King when we can, mm-hmm. except for the fact that I have a love-hate relationship with most of his stuff.
I feel like, yeah, Stephen King's polarizing in that aspect, for sure.
I mean, so is Cronenberg. But yeah.
But so, I mean, Cronenberg is fucking brutal though.
Cronenberg has a special place in my heart because body horror scares the shit out of me, so I read about as much about it as I can to sort of get over it.
Yeah.
But it's really fascinating once you start reading about it.
No, I agree, actually. It's one of those like spicy food kind of things mm-hmm. where I'm like, now I have to watch more, but I can't go too hard. I'm not doing like a 5 fucking speed.
No, yeah. And it also, just as a side note, it brings me great pleasure to know that Henry Zebrowski walked into a doctor's room and saw up his ass.
When was this?
This was in an episode of the last podcast where he was, like, at the doctor's office and he walked into a doctor's room.
Mm-hmm.
And this doctor was literally, like,
doing an
exam on fucking Cronenberg.
Wow.
Which just brings me great pleasure. But yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, that's it.
Damn, guys. You learned a lot about how this fucking Cronenberg, man. Body horror. Body horror. We haven't done body horror yet.
No.
This is going to be a thing. One of our, of course, genres we're pulling uh-huh. from here. But, like, yeah, this is some shit.
So, that was it for the production and special effects and everything. So, now we get to kind of just launch into free talk where we have some kind of guiding questions. But, yeah, they're sort of, you know, guiding questions. So, whatever, you know, thoughts you have. So, let me pull up my handy dandy notebook. So, your initial impression having watched it for the first time yesterday.
It was yesterday, yeah.
How was it?
Well, we watched it because, so first we learned that the apartment he has was very similar to my apartment.
Super similar.
Like, guys, if you've seen the movie, my apartment is like a slightly smaller version of that.
Totally.
Apartment. Without the pods, obviously. But it's funny because during the scene when he like shows her the apartment and he starts playing the piano, we all look to the right.
Because you there's have a piano. A stage, yeah.
And a stage and everything. It's fucking awesome. But yeah, we put it on the big screen projector with a huge fucking surround sound. And to absorb in complete darkness. So to absorb this film,
one of these days we have to watch like one of the movies like at the same time using that.
Because, oh, I'm down. Like... one of these fucking weekends, let's do it.
Okay.
Because like yes, it made a huge difference on the film.
It made
a huge
difference. I watched it on my laptop.
Oh, okay. That'd be a little tough. But you know what? It's gruesome imagery no matter what.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's a lie. Half of it I watched at my dad's house, which mm-hmm. he has, like, Bose surround sound. Like, he has nice shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, the last 30 minutes I watched it. 3:30 at night because I couldn't sleep.
See, those last 30 minutes are the worst fucking parts too. Before sleeping,
I mean, I was up significantly later after that.
But... yeah, you're like, you know what'll keep me up?
No, it's just I just wanted to watch it again because I'd already finished the episode mm-hmm. or like finished writing the episode, but I still wanted to watch it again
because
I enjoy
it.
Suffering.
Yeah,
it's
just, right.
It's a very emotional.
Bit of a masochist.
I do. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah.
No. But it's a really sad like ending. Like the last 30 minutes. Like, I mean, I think it's also very easy for Gina Davis to sort of pull from her own emotions in mm-hmm. that aspect. But it was like really upsetting.
Yeah. I could see her hesitation and everything. It's like
also mm-hmm. in the dream sequence where Gina Davis's character gives birth to a maggot.
Yeah.
The gynecologist in that scene was David Cronenberg.
course it was.
That was his cameo in the movie.
Mr. fucking Dead Ringers over here. He's like, you know, I like, this gives me an idea.
Yeah, basically. Well, actually, I think Dead Ringers came up before.
It was 1988.
Was it 88? Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I think that was the catalyst right there.
Yes, this was also one of, I think, the second or third movie he both wrote, directed, and produced.
Oh, shit. Dude.
So he's a real John Carpenter in that
sense. Yeah, he's definitely one of those, like, I need to, creative control, obviously.
Yeah, he wanted to get his hands on everything. But it's really cool that he, you know, still rewrote the script, carte blanche, and still
credited Pogue. Like, that he did that was awesome.
That's really cool.
But also, when we were watching the movie, my friend, he wanted to let us know to mention this, was that the Apple podcast fucked up about 13 minutes into it. Or the Apple TV.
Uh-huh.
And it stopped on a line where he talks about, where he's about to introduce her to the apartment, but he says the word, I got one word for you. Cheeseburger. Like, he says that one line and he goes to the burger place, right? It kept freezing and we troubleshooted for like 40 minutes trying to figure out what was happening, and we would just keep replaying that line. And as it was playing, we would just mouth it like, oh, another word. Cheeseburger. Just nonstop until we like put the Chromecast in. Fuck it. The Chromecast worked beautifully. But
was that some shade at Apple?
No. I think it's we had to update the Chromecast too. So it kept being shit nonstop. But we finally got the thing working.
You got past your technical difficulties.
As we did. Yeah, but it made the movie much longer. It added 40 minutes to our initial time.
Oh yeah.
But man, it was honestly like it was worth it, because that shit, this is just, it's almost Spielberg-y sometimes.
Yeah,
like in terms of the music and the camera work and everything, mm-hmm. like it pulls towards where it needs to pull, and it gives you a resounding, like almost fantastical score, but eerie. Yeah. Everything's just like a corrupt version of a Spielberg. It's like if Cronenberg did E.T., it would look a lot like this fucking film.
You think?
Oh, yeah. E.T. be fucking experimented on in the beginning.
I've never seen E.T. though.
Oh, you've never seen it? It's very wholesome, but it has
why I probably haven't seen it.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't like happy things.
It has darkish elements, but it also comes, it's very, you know, cheesy Spielberg ending, kind of like, and then everybody was happy, yay! This one's like, I'm crying.
Yeah, basically. Well, so,
what did you think of the film?
I really enjoyed it. I, as someone who has worked with Cronenberg's stuff before, like in an academic sense, it was really interesting. I liked, you know, knowing that it was definitely Cronenberg and it felt very Cronenberg.
Yeah, it's as Cronenberg as you can Cronenberg on this.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed the special effects, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
The filmmaking, or like sort of how they approach some of the scenes, because I mentioned this in my thoughts and questions, but the very beginning, it introduces the movie in the middle of a conversation, and that immediately kind of stood out to me as like an unconventional way to start a movie.
Yeah, they don't like kind of ease you in. Here's the story.
Right, it feels like you're entering the movie in the beginning of a scene, which I think is a really cool, abrupt way to really pull your viewer in, because immediately you're entranced by what's going on, because you're trying to figure out what's going on.
That's true. It makes you have to pay attention, because you're like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Who are you? What's going on?
And is that Jeff Goldblum?
Is that Gina Davis? Like, so that was really cool. And then also, like, obviously, like, both of them in this movie made it kind of hard to watch, because I really did not want to see Jeff Goldblum become mutated.
Mm.
Because both Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis are very bangable in this movie.
Yeah. We were actually, we all clapped when we saw Gina Davis' side boob.
Oh my god.
We all were just like, yeah! It was a total bro moment between everybody. It was funny.
And then I'm there rolling my eyes.
It's just like, no, you know Gina Davis' side boob. Come on, you're smiling.
I would have been cheering on the inside.
Cheering on the inside, that makes sense.
Because I'm not a fucking...
But Gina Davis had that 80s hair, too.
She did. No, she's super hot in the movie. And, like, her cheekbones and, like, her, like, jaw structure. Like, she's super hot. But, no, it was, it was good. No, I liked the movie. It was very weird to watch with my dad.
Yeah, I imagine that would have been a little fucked up. For sure. No.
Yeah. Watching it with my dad was a little strange, but sometimes it'd be like that. We were all like really tired though, because it was like the day after his birthday, So we were just, like, all kind of dozing, like, watching, and I was, like, half paying attention.
Very sprawled out on the couches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, my legs were up. I was just like, oh, I could fall asleep right now, but then also... they're fucking, so I feel like I can't not pay attention.
Well, I think that's a good way of lying to encapsulate this whole film. I think I can't not pay attention. Like, yeah. You can't not any scene. Like, every scene is used. Important.
Well, yes. Yeah, that's the thing, and that's what I really like, because they're able to pack so much effective storytelling in 90 minutes that no scene goes unused. Yeah. Like, there's no fluff.
No, there's absolutely. In fact, even if they threw that fucking monkey cat scene in here,
it'd still be important.
It's important because later on in the film, you see Goldblum's character on the roof, which you never see him leave after he gets the transformation. That scene would establish him being able to actually get out and do that.
Yeah.
So it shows the in between because there's a big jump in transformation also.
Totally.
So even that little scene that nobody gets to see has a structural importance to the rest of the film, which is. Good filmmaking. Mm-hmm. That's just good filmmaking right there.
Yeah, I think it was super effective. But I think one of the things that fucked me up the most was the final Brundle thing transformation. Yeah.
With this metallic shit inside of him?
Yeah, with the being fused with the telepod and like all of that was really upsetting.
Yeah.
Like it was, the only way I can really describe it is it was really unsettling and it made me feel yucky. Like, well, definitely squicky.
It's one of those things where, you know, I've seen Akira a million times. And I've always wanted to see it in live action, even though there's, like, a whole thing behind that, which would never happen. But there's that mutation at the end with the metallic mix of the flesh. To see it actualized was, like, fascinating. Because I'm like, oh, dude, yeah, the portion of the telepod is now basically his leg.
Yeah.
And protruding at his chest.
Yeah, and he's, you know, like, dragging behind him wires and tubes mixed with flesh, and it's upsetting.
And it's not just human, it's fly shit, too.
Yeah, it's so fucking grotesque.
Oh, man,
like,
dude.
It's like, grotesque. Yeah, that's the only way I can really describe it.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, it's absolutely grotesque.
But yeah, so that's, like, I think that was one of the most, like, I was really fucked up by that. One of the things that I did really also enjoy was that even though the technology was very dated, it didn't feel very dated.
No, it felt sci-fi.
It felt very, yeah. For something from the mid-80s to still hold up as long as it has and still have dated elements while still telling an effective story, I think that's really one of the things that sets this apart from other horror films from the 80s to make it stand alone as not just a horror film, but just a good film in general.
Well, yeah, nothing in this movie, like, even though it's dated, you don't get pulled out.
No.
You don't get, the only thing that pulled me out of the movie was, like, the age of the car that he drove. And there's nothing you can do about that. Nothing you can do about that. The car's going to look like a 1986 car no matter what. But interesting. They actually, also one thing. In terms of technology-wise, the only other thing that I thought was like, oh no, was the way he was typing with one finger on each hand. It was like that old school, like, I don't know how to use a QWERTY keyboard style. Yeah. But he's like this fucking amazing scientist. So that was the only thing where I was like,
I just thought that was him being quirky.
Okay, I can actually see that being a quirk.
Because it was like, he was like typing like one-handed, and like, I do that.
No, that's true.
And I've been typing since I was like 5.
But when he does the two, it's like the T-Rex arms just going
when
down.
When he's doing that, that's when his hands are melded together, and he can only type.
No, that's later on, yeah, but he still does it.
In the beginning?
Yeah.
Does he?
I'm pretty sure he types with just one finger most of the time.
Yeah, I just thought that was him being quirky.
But it's also, I look at it like, well, he's probably an old school scientist transitioning to this digital world. So obviously some shit's going to get lost in translation there.
Apparently also computer chips will get lost in his bed.
Yeah.
Which is just a pull-out couch.
he does live like a bachelor. Like, yeah, straight up.
He's a bachelor scientist in a loft in
some shady fucking area.
Some city.
Yeah, we could not figure out what city this thing was from. Like, we kept trying to find landmarks and stuff, and there's no, it's honestly...
It's an unnamed city, for sure.
And you know what?
It felt kind of Los Angeles, though.
Yeah, it seemed like, like a really grimy... Well, it would be shot in this fucking apartment complex, honestly. It would make sense. But no, I think that it's so not an established city, that it actually increases its appeal.
Yeah, because it can be anywhere. It. Yeah, yes, you're not exactly. You're not tied to a particular landscape because, like, I mean, that makes total sense because, like, no one can tell where it takes place, which is effective Because, like, for example, what if, like, they said that it took place in Los Angeles, but then by 2018, Los Angeles didn't look like that at all.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it's able to maintain a timelessness to it by not putting it in a particular location.
And then having the set and the city itself be, like, just, I don't know, that 80s urban sprawl. Like, it's actually pretty perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the deleted scene with the monkey cat, like, he goes on the roof and he sees lights in a city, but you still can't figure it out. It's like, you literally just can't do it. Right. Yeah.
They did film this in Vancouver.
Oh, okay. Well, then Vancouver in 86, man. If anybody probably, all were around.
That's probably what you were looking at. Yeah. But I think it lacked an identifying mark.
Exactly. Well, because Vancouver is a stand-in for a lot of cities anyways. Exactly. And
like, so, like, Vancouver, like, so much filming happens in Vancouver that, like, it's pretty much just a default city.
That's true. Also, fun fact for y'all that I just remembered right now. Cronenberg, up to this point, always films in Canada. He always filmed in Canada. He always had his own crew who were like a family to him, working with him since the 70s.
That's cool.
Yeah, so whenever they had to actually get Cronenberg on board for this, they had to shoot in Canada. They're like, that's one of the stipulations. You're going to bring everybody you need over there. I have my crew. Every year we do one film. This is going to be it for The Fly. You got me. But you have to be in my hood. So
he's like, Cronenberg is a surprisingly not horrible person.
No, he's not. Like, he really backs everybody up. He believes in his work, I think.
Yeah.
Like, he really, and people doing a good job for him.
I feel like there's a certain level of cockiness with that he knows he's hot shit, but also he's David fucking Cronenberg, so I guess he has that right.
His last name's a verb.
Yeah. No, yeah.
Something's been Cronenberg, man. Yeah. That's fucked. Like, yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that. No, it's interesting. I want to do more research into, like, him as a director, because, like, clearly he has some issues.
Yeah, he does. That's true. I would really, well, you know, we have several Christmases to tackle the psychology of Cronenberg.
Oh, yeah.
Because you got to think of, like, okay, the one good example is this is how the movie had to make Jeff Goldblum more appealing through cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Cronenberg obviously is a no-nonsense guy, but, like, the fucking, what's his name? John Getz's character.
Mm-hmm.
Stathis?
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck with that guy, though? Like, how did Cronenberg in his mind envision, and, like, oh, and then they're going to be together afterwards, or whatever it is, with the alternate endings?
Well, I think it just, Stathis immediately, because, like, he wasn't awful in the second half of the movie.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't awful, but I think it just, he does, I think in this particular day and age, he left a particularly nasty taste in my mouth when he just was in his ex's apartment and he wouldn't give her the key back.
Yeah.
Which, like, I would just be like, what?
Well, so for the
someone would be getting shot at that point. Yeah. Like,
and she just took it and was like, oh, okay, fine, take the fucking key.
I know, she was so chill about it. She was just like, ugh, fine, and like, eye roll. And I'm just like, girl, you're in danger.
It's like, you married your stalker, man.
Like, yeah. Like, I wouldn't even know. Like, he became, like, her support in the second half of the movie, and he seemed to still genuinely care about her, but he had a lot of creepy behavior in the beginning that, like, I was just like, oh, he's a stalker.
But, like,
point blank, a stalker.
Guys, like, if you haven't seen this film, it's really fucking creepy behavior for, like, a first half of the film, the first legit half. This guy's, like, perving nonstop.
Stalker 101. Like, he is, and he is her boss.
Yes. It's
he's in a position of power over her, and he's showing up at her apartment because he still has a key and he won't give it back. And she literally walks into her apartment thinking she's alone, and he's in the shower.
Yeah.
Like, he still lives there.
No, not only that, when she talks up to Goldblum about how they met, it's like, I'm not sure if it's in the movie or in a deleted scene.
Oh, okay.
But it's like, oh yeah, he was my former college professor, and then we, and
that is in the movie.
Yeah. So that creeped me out immediately. I'm like, are you shitting me? He was her professor. She was the student.
And then he became her boss.
And they are fucking, like, divorced and shit, or exes, or I don't know what.
Yeah,
the
they're exes.
They're exes.
And I don't, like, the first half of the movie, he's a piece of shit, garbage, creepy, motherfucking son of a bitch.
I love the way you put that. That's absolutely it. That's, yeah, guys, nobody's going to get a worse insult than that any character we do. But it's absolutely true. This guy fucking sucks for a lot of the film. But it's interesting because to me, it makes it see Gina Davis' character, Veronica, as a perpetual victim. Like, she starts off hard at the beginning.
She's
hard edge.
Very,
like,
very stereotypical of, like, a woman journalist in the 80s.
Yeah, like, having, like, to take shit from everybody.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
And she takes no shit, and she still, and for the movie, and also probably just for the fashion of the time, like, women's fashion was super masculine. Like, mm-hmm. she...
Shoulder pads and
yeah,
shit,
like,
yeah.
Like, shoulder pads and, like, suits, and, like, she wore, like, pantsuits, like, most mm-hmm. of the film, like, you know, so...
But she was so combative, even to Jeff Goldblum,
mm-hmm.
for oh, yeah. a lot of the film in the beginning.
Even in the very beginning, like, she mm-hmm. was like, okay, you're pulling, like, you're talking out of your ass. I'm gonna go.
Yeah. See, and but with all her backstory and stuff, it lets you know exactly how tough she's had it to get to this point. But then Goldblum is, like, this, like, perpetual nice guy at the beginning. He's just, like,
right, like,
I just want you to see this because I thought we were having a good time.
Yeah. No, yeah. Jeff Goldblum was definitely an interesting character in the beginning. I was endeared, but...
Yeah, he's a fucking nerd.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what, though? He's a nerd that, like, has passion and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But when he does the transformation, it's like, oh, you're the nerd that nobody can tell anything.
Yeah.
And you think you're fucking right all the time. Fuck, you are. But...
yeah, no. I mean, there's his... What I really... And why I understand people, like, praise his performance so much
mm-hmm.
is because he... his character goes through so many personality shifts, and he makes them fucking seamless.
That's a good point. Yes, he makes it incredibly seamless.
Like, you can see that transition, and it never once feels out of place or out of character.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that very last moment where he's kind of, like, gripping onto his reality, and he's like, you need to leave and never come back, because I'm turning into an insect, and I will hurt you.
I love that scene, because he, like... comes to that realization of what's going to happen. He
yeah.
talks about insects being brutal and nature being brutal. And he's like, because of that, go and never come back.
Yeah. And it's like, it's not mean.
It's not mean.
It's
no.
just out of, you know, concern and out of care for her. And if, like, this movie was made in, you know, like in 2018, it would be a lot more aggressive, I
yeah.
think.
No, it Well, that's the thing. I don't think any actor can put that tone where, like, you understand where he's coming from, and he's still that menacing.
Yeah.
He's still gonna be that menacing, and you know what's going to happen, which is why you understand why he's like, listen, I played this meek whatever scientist before,
mm-hmm.
and that person is coming out temporarily to tell you to get the fuck out, because I'm not gonna be that person anymore. I'm
yeah.
gonna be this shit.
I'm trying to think, like, what would be a 2018 recasting of The Fly? Like, who would that even be?
Fucking dude, no. There's no. Who?
Like, because also you can't compare anyone really to Jeff Goldblum in the sense that, like...
Yeah, you can't have, like, a lanky kind of person that can match Goldblum. You can't have an awkward... Now, who the fuck would it be?
Exactly.
Okay, I had a thought come in my head right now, and then it just bounced, but it wasn't like a strong thought.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, Mel, like, you know, think about that,
because, yeah,
like, that just occurred to me, and I'm like, I don't even know, like, I wouldn't even begin to know who would be a good... You know what? You guys think about it. If
yes.
you, like, find us on Twitter at horrorpeoplepod, HORROR PEOPLE POD.
Yes.
And tell us who you think your... recasting of The Fly would be in 2018, because
oh
I want to know.
I'd really, yeah, I would love to know this too, because honestly, I can't think of shit, guys.
No, yeah. I would need some time to think about it. If I do think of something, though, I'll post it on Instagram or Twitter or something.
Oh, we can do like an album or something. Who would be out of these options? Oh, yeah, fuck yeah. All right. But then, moving on here, what is the most gruesome portion of this film to you? Because honestly, there's options.
Yeah, no, you have some choices.
There's some fucking options, guys.
I think the Inside Out Baboon.
Oh, fuck yeah.
I think. Because I didn't see the monkey cat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the next best thing.
It's very similar.
Yeah.
Very similar.
So that fucked me up. Like, it made me turn my head. I was just like, nope.
Oh.
Like, when it happened and you just see the bloody handprint just
come up. Yeah.
And I turned my head and I was like, I don't need to know. And of course, I still looked because I needed to know.
Well, I mean, Cronenberg, like, we paid for these effects. They linger the camera on for good, for a lot
of
stuff.
But you just
stuff.
See it twitching and I'm just like, oh, this poor thing.
The spazzing is what really adds to the whole scene.
It also reminded me of that scene from Galaxy Quest. You ever see that?
Yeah, I love Galaxy Quest when they do the transformation.
Yeah, and the pig turns inside out. Yeah, I haven't seen it, I think, since I was like 10, but like, yeah.
Oh my god, that movie's awesome.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
That's a little body horror sometimes, to be honest with
you. Yeah, it's great. I mean, parts of it are definitely disgusting.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a comedy, so.
That's true. They can only go so far. If Cronenberg did a comedy.
Oh god, I wouldn't even know where to start with
awkward
that.
Awkward team of scientists. Just
but, no, yeah. So I think that was the most.
And that's what kicks it off. That's what kicks
right
it off.
Right off the fucking bat. Yeah. What about you?
Taking out the fingernails.
Oh, fuck.
Taking out the fingernails in the mirror and having it just pop off.
Oh, God.
But the thing is, like, he plays with it.
Stop describing it.
And he
stop
just looks at it.
No, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But, like, he holds on to it. She's flipping me off. With her fingers.
That have nails.
Yes.
Fucker.
Oh, but no. Yeah, that got me. That got me real hard.
Yeah, no, that was fucked up. The teeth also.
Well, the teeth, because it's so accidental. I mean, it's accidental to the fingers, too, but he's, like, curious.
He's doing something, and his teeth just falls onto a key and
with
onto
his tongue.
The keyboard.
His fucking just tongue just pushes it out. Forward. It pushes it out forward.
Oh, I hate this. Why are we doing this? Okay.
Yeah. But, yes, those scenes in particular, only mm-hmm. because it's not. Because when you see the full grotesqueness, like. Actually, no. That point's wrong. But it's something that you can kind of envision yourself doing.
Yeah. Well, no, because, like, if... Yeah. I mean, I've lost a thumbnail.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
Do you want to know the story?
Do you listeners want to know? Yeah, if I get tells.
When I was in first grade, I went to a really weird charter school, and basically we had, like... you know, like, Lincoln Logs? You mm-hmm. know, like, we had those, but they were actual wood pieces.
Mm.
And we used rocks and stuff to, like, lift things. And someone dropped a rock on my thumb.
No.
It was a huge fucking rock to, like, first grader? So it was, like, seven.
Lord of the Flies-ing you on your fucking thumb.
Yeah, six or seven. And so the rock was probably only, like, about this big, but I was...
Your fingers were much smaller.
Yeah, I was very tiny.
Yeah.
So someone dropped it on my thumb, and it immediately turned blue and purple, and I freaked out.
Oh, my God.
And my mom, like, I got to go home and, like, all this shit. And then my nail came off.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, well, we learned that thing.
Well, do you want to know how it, like, came off?
How'd it come off?
I got a piece of hermit crab food stuck under it, and I had to peel my nail off because I couldn't get it out.
Oh, what was your sensation? What were you feeling? Like, what in your mind is going on when you did that?
Ow.
Ugh. You're just like, well, I never expected this. That probably fucked you up.
Here's the thing. It's like when you have a loose tooth.
Mm-hmm.
Is like when you're younger and, like, parts of it becomes loose and then it feels like it's just, like, hanging on by a thread.
Yeah.
My nail was basically off and it was just hanging on by, like, the skin on, like, one side of my nail. So mm-hmm. I kind of just had to rip it off.
Okay. Like Goldblum.
Yeah.
He's just like, hey, Cronenberg.
It just brought back some really unpleasant memories of my childhood.
I can definitely see why my teasing may have pushed a little further on right now. Now that I look back at that. But also, one scene that really got me, which I wasn't expecting at all, was him coming out of his skin at the end, in the climax.
Oh, when his jaw?
Not just the jaw part. The jaw part, I was like, okay, fine. Then you did the jaw thing. But when he starts walking... Mm-hmm. And then the flesh goes around the fly stuff and it pulls out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That to me was like, I was like, oh, they're going the whole way. They're not holding back at all.
No,
Holy shit.
It's, like, there's a full fly transformation and it's disgusting.
It's fucking gross. Even the fly head is, like, even convincing with emotion sometimes.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
It's really weird.
Totally, totally. But yeah, I think, so now that you know all of the alternate endings and things that the movie could have ended on, do you agree with the epilogue that they eventually went with, or would you have preferred a different ending?
No, ending as is.
Yeah.
Honestly, there's no better way to just have her shoot fucking credits. Like, that's perfect.
Yeah, I think the way that they did it is it left me wanting more,
mm-hmm.
but also I felt like if they had given it to me, I would have been like, nah.
Nothing would have could have
yeah.
fulfilled,
I think it was the perfect ending in the sense that, yeah, it left you wanting to see more of it,
mm-hmm.
but also I knowing what epilogues we could have gotten, I think if I had gotten any of those outside of that moment, I would have been like, it wouldn't have been as effective, because, like, the ending felt like a punch in the fucking gut.
Yeah, and that's...
like, she shoots his fucking head off, she's crying, and then, like, ends, like, cuts to credits. Like, I'm just like, What?
It was perfect. It was actually perfect.
It felt like a punch in the gut because she's also like super emotional. Like she does nothing but sob for the last like 15 minutes.
And you know what? That's cool because she obviously, based off of her relationship history there, she was into fucking Brundle.
Yeah.
And she was like, no, like this is the only happy, private relationship I've ever had.
Yeah. No,
and
she this was is a career. Genuinely this is happy. This? Yeah.
And she has to be the one to do it. There's... She has to fucking be the one to do it.
Yeah. Because fucking Stathis lost his foot and his hand.
Which was gruesome as fuck.
That was also a really gruesome part.
There's a deleted scene where he eats the foot. And it's fucking gross because he actually has the fly thing suction come out and start sucking.
Because they never showed that.
Yeah,
in the movie
they have that. He actually
they
does
didn't
it.
They didn't show that in the movie because you only see Stathis looking at the TV as he's doing the slurpy thing, and you can hear like the slurpy sounds, but like you never see it. So
that's the only cutaway. That's right.
That's the only thing we don't really get to see.
See, and it's crazy
and
to think
all you see is Stathis' horrified face.
Yeah.
So,
but it's interesting because. That deleted scene that they didn't even get shoot with, he does it to a random lady. Like, think of like that whole thing. Like, spewing that stuff on a skull and then the flesh starts moving down.
Melting off, yeah. No.
Oh, man.
But no, yeah, I think it ended exactly how it should have. And I think it was the most effective, but also the most cohesive way to end the movie without being redundant or gratuitous.
Yeah, of the film.
Within
I feel
the context
like it's
of the film, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree.
It's the perfect pace. No, this is a really well-paced film.
Like, I agree.
I'll watch it again, honestly.
Yeah, I think I might have to give it another shot if I ever really want to fuck someone up at a sleepover. I'm like...
I want to show my nephews, but I don't know if they're old enough to...
How old are they?
11 and 9.
Yeah, no.
An 11-year-old can handle it. You underestimate my family's history.
It's true. I consistently underestimate it.
9-year-old's not going to handle it, though. They're definitely not.
I've already decided that when my niece or nephew turns 10, they're getting the Goosebumps books.
Nice. No, that's good. That's make them readers young, man.
Yeah. But anyway, so I think this is just as a good place as any to end our discussion on The Fly and some your intro to body horror. I'm sure I'll go more into it later as we
add
travel.
Body horror, we'll add some more body horror films. We're for sure actually adding a couple. So not all Cronenberg.
Anthony really enjoyed this, so it was good.
I for some reason, brutality, I guess, that gets the enthusiasm out of me. Whatever, you know?
But no, yeah. So thank you everyone for joining us. Thank you to Anthony's friend who suggested we did Cronenberg because...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's out there. Maria. So we did it.
Because what a great recommendation, because this was super, super fun.
It was.
This was really enjoyable, actually. I had a lot of fun researching this.
And it's a really well-made film. Like, it's just well-made, honestly. Like,
great.
Pacing,
yeah.
Shots, effects, acting.
Yeah.
It has it all.
It was fantastic.
And Gina fucking Davis, guys, in her prime.
Jeff fucking Goldblum.
Oh, dude.
No, this is a great, like, very attractive cast, for sure.
It is, yeah.
But
so John Getz, man, you fucked up.
So creepy.
He is a little creepy.
So creepy. But yeah, so that was... Oh,
and then next week, guys, we're going to bring something that gives me nightmares every time I watch it.
I am unbothered.
Yeah, no, she's unfazed, but I don't know why. I'll get into it about actually why it gives me nightmares from early childhood.
It is a very, you know what? It is, from what I understand, this movie scared the shit out of everyone under the age of, like, 12. Like,
yeah, if you're watching it around the time it was a thing. It's iconic horror, though, so we're getting one of the big dogs.
It's iconic. It's also kind of, not, like... classless, but it's kind of B-listy.
It's definitely B-listy, and I actually think it is a little classless, because especially the later sequels. But
so it's a franchise.
It's a franchise, guys, and we're bumping into it, and we're gonna.
It's
keep
a great way to ring in Christmas for sure.
That's a good way. We'll leave it at that. It's a fucking great way to ring in Christmas, except for one character it's not good for them. But you'll find out in a week.
Yeah, so you'll find out next week. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. As always, we love hearing from you, and we love hearing your thoughts on the movies that we've been covering. We're always open to recommendations. Clearly, we changed our entire schedule just to cover and introduce our Cronenberg Christmas series.
Absolutely.
So, as always, feel free to hit us up on all the social medias. You can find us on Instagram at Horrible People's Podcast, And I apparently, my mom's fiancé told me I needed to emphasize how it's spelled because he couldn't find us anywhere.
Actually, that fucks up a couple of people also. So, horrible.
H-O-R-R-O-R-B-L-E. Horrible.
People's podcast.
There you go.
You should know how to spell people and podcast, guys.
Yeah. And then you could find us on Twitter at Horror People Pod, as I discussed earlier, and I did spell that out in a very slow graphic detail. So please feel free to follow us there and hit us up if you have any questions or, you know, want to yell at us or if I completely got something wrong. I run the Twitter and Anthony pretty much handles the Instagram at this point. Every now and again. But for the most part, Instagram's kind of Anthony's thing. So, and Twitter's mine.
Yeah.
And that's why we work so
well. Our strengths.
But yeah, and then if you feel so inclined, you can also follow us on our personal Instagrams. Mine is The Blonde Dictionary, and Anthony is at Hyrulean Hustler. So, yeah. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one, guys. Have a good week.
Peace out, fuckers.
Bye.